last time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. This week's show is about sound, and more specifically, the sound created by one man. As a guitarist and vocalist, songwriter and producer, he created sounds that formed albums that changed everything. He leads one of the most influential bands ever. They formed in the 80s but didn't sound like anything else at the time. In fact, despite the other groups that emulated them and the genre that sprung up in their wake, no one can recreate the noise that they make. This band also created a masterpiece, but not without a certain amount of difficulty. He's not someone who often embarks on interviews like this, so it makes me very pleased and proud to say my guest on The First Time this week is Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine. And you just heard Only Shallow from My Bloody Valentine's classic 1991 album, Loveless. And over the next hour, I'll talk to Kevin about his earliest influences and the roots of his band and the making of that record under the chaotic and hedonistic umbrella of Creation Records. We'll also talk about how post-punk and hip-hop both helped to shape the sound of My Bloody Valentine and his own role as a sometime member of Primal Scream and the friendship and collaboration at the heart of that relationship. But I started off by asking Kevin, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
It's difficult. There was quite a lot of music, basically, since I was born. My parents used to go to, like, dances, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and they used to bring me in a little crib.
Really?
You know,
that's
so
sweet.
Yeah,
that's really
so
sweet.
So I'd be somewhere in a corner with lots of expat Irish people getting very drunk and rowdy. And so I kind of grew up with that. You know, I literally grew up, like, from my earliest memory, I think I've just been around thumping music, you know.
Was it really important to your family? Was music something that kind of featured in the household on a day-to-day kind of basis as well?
Kind of. I mean, as I said, we were in America, and they used to love going to those kind of dances and things that they used to do in New York, and there seemed to be lots of singing and music all the time. But at the same time, I was in the 60s, you know, as a kid growing up. You know, it was everything that was coming. It just seemed to be everywhere. You know, it's hard to describe, really, but no, it's really weird. It's like it's a bit like saying, "Can you remember the first time you ate food?"
It was just, it's just there all the time as a part of life. I think it was like a lot of Irish folk music, that kind of big rolling kind of social thing.
Yeah, I could experience quite a lot of that. My dad was very much a guy who liked to belt out songs and, you know, everything you can imagine.
What sort of songs did he used to sing? Can you remember any specific classics?
All the classics, yeah, all of them. You know, like Fields of Athenry, I guess, is his favourite.
By a lonely prison wall, I heard a young girl calling. Michael, you stole Trevelyan's corn, so the young might see the morn. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay. Low lie the fields of Athenry, where once we watched the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing, we had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry.
The irony of all of that was that because I was a kid and I was in America, and I was actually what I got into, you know, it was like the Monkees and the Partridge Family and all those kind of TV show stuff, you know, that kids kind of absorb. And I very much aligned myself with the Monkees in my head, you know, very much. Like, I even dressed like them, and, you know.
Really? Brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to get in all sorts of trouble at school because people forget, you know, but back in, say, 1971 or something, or 72, in America, most kids had a crew cut. That was the kind of child kind of
the standard
issue. Yeah,
buzz cut,
yeah.
Sort of almost army look.
Kind of, yeah. It was like that in America compared to, you know, like I know like in England and Ireland and all that, it was absolutely all the kids had long hair, you know, but not in America. They were all pretty much crew cuts, and all the kids wore shorts in the summer, and I refused to wear shorts. So I had to wear my bell-bottom trousers and my Beatles haircut, you know.
What was the Monkees tune for you then? Because I still, to this day, I love the kind of, not even a vault fast, but the kind of jump from the Monkees to the Monkees who did Head. I still think it's one of those brilliant moments in kind of such an incredibly avant-garde leap. But for you, was there like a defining kind of bubblegum moment of theirs that you really loved?
I don't know. I mean, I guess The Last Train to Clarksville always pops into my mind just because of the guitar bit being really Beatlesy, you know. But funny enough, my favourite song is Porpoise Song from Head.
Oh man, what a tune. First single you bought, what would be the first track? Because that's a different thing when you go out and you kind of buy something because it's for you.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting records, especially when we moved to Ireland when I was 10 and I discovered Top of the Pops. So I was getting those really terrible Top of the Pops albums with girls in swimsuits.
Oh, yeah, like all kind of covers of the big hits, but not the actual hits.
These anemic kind of versions, yeah. And even then I kind of knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was, you know, but... But yeah, I remember getting them, acquiring them, you know, but I didn't really couldn't go to the shops myself. But by the time I was 11, we lived beside a big supermarket, mostly groceries, but there was a record shop there. And there was this kind of big, I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was definitely like 74 or something, there was the first re-promotion of the Beatles, and there was this kind of series of Beatles 7-inches that were coming out every month, I think. They all had the same kind of cover. They were kind of like, on one side they were white with just the name of the track, and the back side it was just like a photograph from around the kind of Revolver era. And so I got help. I went by myself to the shop, you know, and bought this record by myself and took it home, and it was just like my first personal experience, basically, I guess, of buying my own music. Yeah, and that record, that particular single, was just, I played it, you know, a thousand times, you know, kind of, used to put my head up against the record player speaker and sing along to it, probably completely out of tune, but somehow thinking that I could do all the harmonies with the Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my mate first record, really, that I bought myself.
I need somebody, help. Not just anybody, help. You know I need someone, help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now these days are gone, days I'm gone. Not so self-assured, and now I find, I've changed my mind, I'll open up the doors.
We should probably, I know you've talked about it before, but we should talk about the first guitar that you owned. What was your relationship like with that instrument? Was it something that you longed for and had an instant affinity with, or was it something that you took a while to kind of become friends with?
I had decided in my head, I started going to gigs in 79. There was this thing in Dublin called the Dandelion Market, and it was at the weekend, at between sort of 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock kind of thing, there would be bands playing in this kind of underground car park kind of thing. And basically, watching the bands and going, I think I kind of get this, you know, I can see that they're just kind of playing these punk songs and just going up and down. And and so I kind of thought I could play bass. And the first song I worked out was Harmony in My Head by the Buzzcocks.
Nice.
It was basically following the chords. And a few months later, I met a kid and his brother, and they just said, we're forming a band. The kid was forming a band. He was only 13. And he just said, do you want to play guitar? And so I went, all right.
Didn't really think I can do that.
Well, I thought I could play bass, but the guitar I didn't think about, really. You know, I just thought bass was the thing I would do. And this was like in, say, October.
Right.
And so I spent the next 2 months really begging and canvassing on my behalf to get a guitar, basically, saying I'll pay it back and I'll do this and I'll work and I'll do this and the other. And,
yeah.
And so I got my guitar for Christmas. You know, I didn't know what to think of it. You know, it was just like, it had a tremolo arm, and I was like, immediately, it went massively. It took me probably 3 or 4 months to really realize how to tune it properly. I was tuning the first 4 strings correctly, but the last 2 I had completely out of tune because I didn't understand about the thing where you drop down 1 note for the last 2 strings when you're tuning across the guitar. So, and my first amplifier was, funnily enough, one of those, a reel-to-reel tape machine with speakers that was used for all those like little dances that were
And
parties, and so that became my amplifier, and it was very distorted, I remember.
So,
uniquely distorted. I didn't realize what a distorted amplifier I had, but
so already, even at that early age, you're kind of reveling in distortion and strange tunings. It was there, it was written in the stars from the minute you picked it up,
whether I wanted to or not.
We should talk about the Ramones, really. When did you first come across the Ramones? Because this is a band that you've mentioned many times as kind of representing a certain kind of like perfection.
You know, I was getting into the punk bands like most kids were through Top of the Pops and television, and you know, it was quite a well covered phenomenon, punk. You know, back in say 77, 78, 79. So you know, bands like the Buzzcocks and stuff, I really loved. But just as a kid in school, you know, like lots of other kids were just into the bands. They weren't necessarily punks or anything like that. But anyway, there was a documentary sometime in 79 I saw on TV about punk, and they had this early Ramones footage of them all playing in a room, or what kind of a white room. And I just suddenly, everything just clicked. You know, for me, I was like, they seemed like strange, like weird aliens. And it was just so singular. And I was just, beside myself, telling all my friends, like, did you see that show? And blah, blah, blah. The Ramones were like, yeah, I've heard of them, blah, blah, blah. You know, nothing, no one was overreacting to it.
What's wrong with you people?
Yeah. And I became like, even my school, me and a friend of mine, I became kind of the Ramones, kind of always playing them at lunchtime and, on a cassette player. And ironically enough, just when we were into all that, the Ramones had that hit Baby I Love You.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the kids in school were going, that's the band that you're going on about? It's like, they're not a punk band, you know? And I was going, yeah, but you know, you have to hear the records, you know, the other albums. When I saw them live around that period.
All right, how was that?
That was incredible. That was actually an incredible experience. It was like one of those movies from the 50s where before the Ramones came on, the security were really heavy, and getting into the gig was a huge hassle because all the local kids were throwing stones at all the punks trying to get into the gig. And
wow.
There was lots of violence, and there was an awful lot of violence back in those days at gigs in Ireland for some reason. It was just part of the thing. You know, I mean, it wasn't that bad either. I mean, you could also avoid it quite easily, you know.
Yeah.
But it didn't stop me from going out or doing anything. But anyway, getting into it was a big deal. Got into the gig, then the security were really heavy and they weren't allowing anyone to get out. It was a cinema and everyone was seated like in a cinema.
Right.
And no one was allowed to even stand up.
No way.
You know, everyone had to sit down. Yeah.
Oh, good luck with that.
And, yeah. And then the Ramones came on and it was insanely loud. Basically, everybody just rushed forward. And I remember I was like halfway back or whatever. And all I remember was walking over cinema seats and they were collapsing under me. So I was doing it another 1,000 kids were doing the same thing. And the whole place literally got destroyed. It was destroyed, flattened, you know, and security disappeared. You know, and it was amazing. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't decipher what songs they were playing. You know, it was just this huge, incredible, crazy thing.
The first rehearsal, the first My Bloody Valentine rehearsal, what can you remember from that? Was it, because, you know, there's always the kind of band myth of like, yeah, the first time these people got into a room together, they looked at each other and, yeah, this is a thing. This is what we wanted. This is the noise that we wanted to make. And other times it's like, yeah, we were rubbish for years. Which one?
Yeah, well, more like rubbish for years. Sort of. I mean, yes and no. I mean, it was weird. I mean, me and Colm were together from the beginning.
Yeah.
So we literally learned how to play together. Like in our first rehearsals, he couldn't do a drum beat. I didn't know how to tune a guitar, you know. And then by the time that our first singer joined when we became My Bloody Valentine was Dave Conway. Mm. And he came down to our house. We saw an ad and he had put an ad up somewhere in a record shop. And we answered it and met him and came down to our house and we did a rehearsal. And immediately we did a really good, strange kind of song thing.
Yeah.
And so it did click. There was a sense of something clicking, but then it was just, yeah, meandered around doing all sorts of things. I mean, when we first started, I had a four-track cassette thing, a TIAC,
yeah.
You know, for Tascam. We kind of based ourselves around the four-track, you know, making these tapes, backing tapes of drones and strange whatever, you know, clattering. Ornsturz and Neubauten were kind of a thing that we were quite into at the time. And so we were really messing around with making drone noises. And then we were also into the birthday party. So in a way, you could imagine us as kind of like pretty much this tape-based experimental thing with a kind of a explosive birthday party jamming kind of
element. Yeah.
Yeah, we just would make it up as we go along kind of thing. mood of most bands back then in the, say, 83, was kind of serious.
Right.
Yeah, there was a kind of already a kind of careerist, serious attitude to a lot of people that were in that we were coming across.
Yeah, this was going to be one of my questions, sort of like, by the time you get to the first This Is Your Bloody Valentine album, how kind of driven were you? How much was there a plan?
Well, we just left. We were in Dublin. We just didn't feel, we didn't connect with anything there. And we met this guy, Gavin Friday from the Virgin Prunes, who was a band I really admired a lot and was a big fan of. And we persuaded Dave, who lived near him, to just ask him on the street, you know, just go up to him and ask him, does he have any advice?
Oh, was it as random as that? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he was very kind and said, I'll give you a list of things and meet you another day, you know, near here or whatever. And it was on the street, you know, it was no mobile phones, no phones involved. And he gave us a list of names in Europe, and he just said, don't go to London, it'll be too hard. You know, you'll just get swallowed up. But go to Europe and you'll find it much easier. And he was right,
yeah.
Basically. So we just left, you know, we just thought, let's just leave and go on a kind of adventure.
It's a pretty brave thing to do for a young band.
Kind of, not really. But everyone was leaving Ireland in those days. It wasn't like a weird thing. But, you know, they would go to America or London, really. And for us, it was more like just going on some kind of adventure, you know, and just seeing what happens.
Yeah.
You know, we went to Holland with one gig and just wound up sleeping in this place called The Last Waterhole in Amsterdam, which was it was full of junkies and misfits and all sorts of strange people. And no bedding or anything, just these basic mattresses on things and sleeping in our coats. You know, it was very whatever, but we're 20 years old, you know. It was just a lot of fun, to be honest. And we were asked to make the record, and when we went to Berlin, we were asking for gigs, and the guy said, do you want to make an album? And we were like, well, we don't even have an album's worth of stuff, really. So we made a mini album. We didn't take ourselves that seriously. I think we were just searching for an attitude in music, you know, that was that singular, uncompromising thing. But at the same time, we got into, through the Milkshakes, actually, the Milkshakes came to Dublin, and we kind of really got into that kind of garage music kind of scene.
Yeah.
And that wasn't really about taking yourself so seriously, you know. There was a sort of humour and a sort of acceptance of this is cool because it's cool, not because I'm a genius and inventing a new way of playing or something. Do you know what I mean? That wasn't the attitude. It was very much about just doing whatever, enjoying music for the sake of music, really. It was weird, but the whole My Bloody Valentine thing was a kind of a concept there with the kind of poppy songs, and but live we were always quite noisy.
Yeah.
There was a full-onness to it that it isn't easily captured, you know, on cassettes I've heard and stuff like that, because it was just this extremely caustic white noise kind of thing happening the whole time, more like a cymbal playing than a guitar, really. And I kind of dropped that idea completely. I just dropped the whole idea when we made this Ecstasy record in 87. I just got a 12-string guitar, and so for that month when I was re-recording, I just used it the whole time, and then 2 months after that, I was like, God, okay, that was fun, but this is not the music I want to be playing. And quite weirdly, like, I actually saw an old interview of ours online,
right?
From 87, and we were basically saying exactly what was going to happen.
Really,
it was weird, but yeah, we were saying this is not really who we are. You know, we're not into that kind of music. We're more into this kind of music, and you know, Sonic Youth and all this Pussy Galore. I remember talking about that was where our heads were at. Yeah, essentially, what happened? Belinda joined the band a few months later. We made that record. It was the first time I sung. Mm. As I said, I was over enamored with my new 12-string guitar. Overused it. Decided I didn't really like that. Went on tour for about 6 months, and that's when we met Creation. And we were in the process of becoming a band, basically, because as I said, Belinda just joined the band in the summer. 8 months later, we'd kind of become who we were going
to
be.
Who you were supposed to be.
Yeah, and then that's when Creation saw us and said, oh, you're quite different than what we remember you as being. And then they said, we're going to make a record. And so we just went in and made that. We made a Real Ass record.
It's interesting when you sort of look back, because obviously, like, the sort of prism of looking back at certain records, it's this, you know, isn't anything comes out and it's instantly held as this incredible piece of work, this classic, this, you know, if I was an American music journalist, I would say seminal. But, you know, at the time, what was the reaction to that like? Can you remember thinking, we've done something that people have got, have they got it? You know, all this idea
kind
behind
of,
the band.
Yeah,
that's great.
I mean, basically, people were, I mean, when the Made Real Ass EP came out, everything changed a lot. And then we pretty much, when it was out, just when it was out, we were in the studio recording as in anything.
Yeah.
And that was when everything was really, we became who we were.
Yeah.
Like, it was all solidified, and this is what we are. And we were very lucky. Like, the engineer, we had a guy called Dave Anderson.
Yep.
He used to play in a band called the Groundhogs at the time, and he used to be in Hawkwind. And so basically, we were recording with this guy, and he just kept on going, this is really different. This is original, you know. I remember recording this All I Need and just going, saying to him, I think this is original. I don't think anyone does this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then just doing stuff and just being just pretty experimental and or just trying things out all the time, you know. We had been sampling before in 87, but you know, we were using it more and more. And we didn't even have samplers. We were just using these Roland delay units where you could make it into a sample.
Yeah, that's right. Those microseconds of stuff you can just play again and again.
Yeah, even longer. Like, we even did the loop for the Public Enemy thing that we did. We did that loop on a Roland delay unit. So it was a good few seconds you could do. You could do sampling in those days without a sampler.
You mentioned Public Enemy. You've got Bring the Noise is one of the songs that you kind of flagged up. To this day, those records sound so remarkable. They still... I don't think you can...
That album in particular to me is just like, it was just such a huge leap, you know, and we got that came out in that summer when we were recording Isn't Anything, and it was just sort of the, being immersed in that record was a big kind of influence. Like, if I went through the album at one point, like, I'd go, look, listen to that bit, and don't you see that that's just exactly what we did in all these songs, and do you know what I mean? Or you can hear the inspiration, you know, it was just heavily, heavily inspiring.
How low can you go? Death row? What a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one. 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X-bun. Now they got me in a cell, cause my records they sell. Cause a brother like me said, well, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you wanna listen to what he can say to you. What you oughta do is follow for now. Power the people say, make a miracle. Deep up the lyrical. Black is back, all in, we're gonna win. Check it out. Here we go again.
That was Bring the Noise by Public Enemy, the choice of my guest on the first time this week, Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine. And the next half hour, I'll be asking Kevin about the almost mythical stories that hang around My Bloody Valentine making their legendary second album. But first, it's the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. This is Andrew Peach. The Health Secretary Sajid Javid has encouraged the Conservative MP Nusrat Ghani, who claims her Muslim faith was raised by a government whip as the reason why she was sacked as a minister in 2020, to make a formal complaint. The Tory chief whip Mark Spencer said he was the person Ms Ghani spoke to, but said the allegations were false and defamatory. The president of the Conservative Muslim Forum, Lord Sheikh, has called for an independent investigation.
You have two scenarios. Parliamentarian A saying something, parliamentarian B saying something. And we need to get to the bottom. We need to establish the truth. If she's saying something which is at odds with what Mark Spencer is saying, well, let's get to the bottom of it.
Russia has accused the UK of provocation after the Foreign Office said it had uncovered a plot by Moscow to install a new government in Ukraine. Thousands of Russian troops amassed on the border with its neighbour. The Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab said Moscow should step back from the brink. He was asked on BBC One's Sunday morning programme about the possibility of a Russian invasion of Ukraine.
I think there's a very significant risk of it, and we need to be clear, the world needs to keep its eye on this and be very clear with President Putin that it would not do this cost-free, that there would be a price in terms of the strenuous defence that we would expect the Ukrainians to put up, also the economic costs through sanctions.
A 16-year-old boy has been stabbed to death in Manchester. The boy was found with stab wounds in Stretford yesterday evening and taken to hospital where he died. Four teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of murder. Talks are taking place in Norway between senior Afghan Taliban officials and envoys from the US and Europe. The new Taliban government isn't recognised internationally, but a Norwegian diplomat said it was important to talk because humanitarian issues in Afghanistan were urgent and getting worse. Tennis. Rafael Nadal remains on course for a record-breaking 21st Grand Slam men's singles title after a straight-set win over Adrian Mannarino. Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller was watching the match.
Mannarino, the Frenchman who's unseeded, he was the guy who didn't finish his match in the previous round until 2:33 in the morning against Aslan Karatsev. Came in to do a news conference at 3:10, so it was very tough for him to come out and play Rafa Nadal. The first set went to a tiebreak, which Nadal won by 16-14, but after that it was just a case of Mannarino hitting the wall and Nadal won sets 2 and 3.
Nadal will meet Denis Shapovalov in the quarterfinals. On to cricket, the England women's cricket captain Heather Knight says it's been a frustrating few days as both of the T20 Ashes series matches against Australia in Adelaide were rained off. England now trail 4-2 in this multi-format series, with the test match starting on Thursday in Canberra. And that's Six Music News for now. More for you at 2:30 this afternoon.
BBC Radio
Six Music.
Hello, welcome back. This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, the show where we ask an influential musician about the pivotal music moments that made them who they are today. And this week, I'm talking to guitarist, vocalist and songwriter Kevin Shields. You just heard When You Sleep from My Bloody Valentine's hugely acclaimed 1991 album Loveless, and I asked Kevin about how he felt with the growing attention that his band were receiving in the lead-up to the release of that album.
Because we'd been around for a few years, and we were kind of quite used to getting mediocre reviews and bad reviews and some good reviews. We always had some people that were into us and stuff. So, you know, it was more like, it wasn't that we were cynical,
right?
But we were not, I could see the way things worked a bit, you know, and I was like, okay, this is like a wave of, you know, the way it used to be with the press.
Yeah.
Essentially, they would jump on something and make it and go crazy about it for a while, and then for sure they would kill that.
Kick
as well.
It down the stairs.
Yeah. So you were kind of, there was a sense of like, okay, this is good, but like, well, we know what comes next.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Which it did. You know what I mean? To some degree, although I think in our case it wasn't so bad because we were somehow used as the kind of vehicle to destroy shoegaze, you know, in a weird way when we released Loveless.
Yeah.
And when we did our tour in 91, they were like, this is killing shoegaze. You know, this is like, we kind of got away with the usual backlash, I guess. But I guess what I'm saying is that we knew it was coming. You know, we knew the cycle, you know, it was a bit more like that.
When you do talk about your career, is there a sort of bit of you that's in the back of your head, you're going, oh, they're going to do the Loveless. They're going to ask about the process and the myths rather than the music. And here we go again. I've got to try and talk about it again. Is there a bit of you that kind of, do you just feel a sort of head in hands, like, oh, I have to document that story again? Because it's such an amazing record. But there's also this kind of parallel myth that people find, and it's a compliment, endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it was a trip. Yeah. There's no question about it. But it was a funny time, you know, because essentially, when we started the record, Creation just went bankrupt. They literally went bankrupt pretty much 2 weeks after we started the record. They'd been with Rough Trade Distribution, and they moved away. And so suddenly they were in a situation where they had to pay for their own records to be printed. And so suddenly they had no money. So it just started off on a really
shaky,
chaotic foot. Yeah, really, really chaotic, really messy. And it stayed messy. But, you know, Creation went from being a label who literally didn't have £1,000 to their name, you know, to being this very successful label, and that all happened from the beginning of Loveless to the end of Loveless.
Yeah.
You know, so it was interesting, you know, interesting time.
Yeah.
The whole club thing was really starting, it was happening anyway, it was happening big time actually, you know, but by the time we started Loveless, it was a very positive time, you know, even though we had a lot of mess and chaos and all that kind of stuff, everything went wrong, it could go wrong kind of thing, it was still the positivity and the newness of so much stuff was overwhelming, you know, and so it didn't feel negative, you know, and also for me, because very early on I took a policy of, or realized, well, everything's pretty crazy, and I've got basically a record company who are only a couple of years older than me who are actually have their minds on drugs, you know, not Dick Green, but Alan McGee was basically, and a few others, so it was more like, all right, I'm on my own here, I know I have a really good record, but it's not really conducive to making a good record, so I just sort of only recorded when it was.
Yeah.
You know, so I would just literally read magazines or watch TV or if it kind of anything crazy. In a weird way, I only remember recording Loveless. Well, it was all good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like my memory of every bit that I recorded was a positive experience.
Yeah.
And the people that were around me were good people. It was, again, that journey of working with good people and then hitting a brick wall and then going, all right, we've got to get out of this studio, you know. And then as Creation got much more solvent, we were able to afford people like Alan Moulder.
Yeah.
And that was a huge pivotal change when he became involved, because I was essentially the only person who knew what was really going on.
Yeah.
And he was very advanced, you know, in his awareness and knowledge of music. And as you know, and he was also this excellent engineer and producer. So it was kind of like suddenly he just got everything immediately and was just like, yeah, you're right. Everything you're doing is correct. Just continue.
We should mention another artist. We probably talk about Jim Askis and Dinosaur Jr. because obviously there's a great kind of brotherhood there. But when did you first meet though? Because that was,
I think, 86 or 87. I think it was, it must have been early 87 because we went to their gig. They played in London.
It must have been great to have seen them at that point. I can't imagine what they would have been like.
Belinda was the one who introduced us to them, actually. She was only into American bands. Black Flag was her favorite band.
Yeah,
it was like, wow, you know, this is different. You know, even Jay singing at the time, I was like, wow, it's different, you know. And even having lead guitar, somehow it didn't annoy me, you know, because I didn't really like a lot of that kind of stuff, you know, and didn't provoke me to ever want to play lead guitar, but I just liked it a lot, you know, I loved it. And we met them when they played, I think, the Fulham Greyhound. We just hung out and just said hi, and they'd heard of us, and we gave them a couple of records. But yeah, we just sort of just became friends just there and then.
Yeah.
More or less.
What track should we play at this juncture then?
Well, You're Living All Over Me, for me, is the one that really affected me first.
Yeah.
And Little Fury Things.
Of the New Deal after Loveless, there's, I think, people that love your band have got this sort of wishful image. You know the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they kind of take the Ark into the warehouse and there's like this almost limitless number of like sort of blank boxes. And I think people are kind of like, oh, somewhere there is a warehouse that's got all these quarter-inch tapes and like endless dats of all this stuff that got recorded kind of in the wake. And is there an equivalent of that? Does it exist? Mm-mm. Is there a huge...
No. What I do have is an insane amount of tunes that is just me on a guitar and singing, you know.
Right.
Like a slightly... an overwhelming amount, you know, really.
Overwhelming.
Yeah, because it's just... a long time ago, I started to try and get on top of it back in... a long time ago, like in the 90s. And already I had 12... dats that were 90 minutes long, full of tunes.
Whoa.
And then that was then, you know, and then so there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, yeah, of tunes and stuff. And the weird thing is that half of them I absolutely don't will ever do, you know, I just recorded them, but the other half I have a real strong weird connection to.
All right.
I'm always like, oh, I have to do something with that someday, and I'm like, but that's impossible, you know, it's impossible to do something with all of them. So that's the only thing I've got that's a bit unusual. But maybe it's not unusual. Maybe a lot of people have that. I don't know. But half of the lyrics are there always.
Oh, right.
You know, for some weird reason, that's always been the way it has been with me. Is I just sing, and somehow a lot of lyrics just come out. So when I finish the song, I've already got a third of it, you know, to start with.
That's quite unusual.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird, but it's just that happens that way. They always have a kind of a theme or a thing. When I make up music, I don't sing nonsense words.
Yeah.
Or I don't sing like la 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 or anything like that. I just sing like I'm singing.
Straight away?
Yeah, always. But I don't know what I'm singing. It's just all made up, well, for my subconscious, yeah. Basically. So, and then when I finish them, I always have to get back into that state.
Yeah.
You know, I can't seem to be, like, what doesn't work for me at all is just being really fresh. It's always have to put myself through hours of just, like, it not really happening, and then I get into that similar state that usually I am when I write music.
Yeah.
And then it comes, you know, but it means I have to go through 4 or 5 hours usually of just it not happening.
Yeah. My brightest stars flying around, let it guide me, experience some deadness sense, bleed inside me, the listener's chance can open me, or untie me, I drift in a space, free of time, I find a higher state of grace. I want to ask you about Primal Scream. There is that There's that lovely quote from Bobby where he, as far as he's considered, you're kind of part of the family and always will be, and the door isn't so much always open, it's like you've never really gone. Why does it work with you guys, do you think? What is it? Because obviously they're a band who approach their music kind of, strangely, on the one hand, in a very traditional kind of rock and roll band sense, but on the other hand, the absolute antithesis of that. And if there's no singer on this track, who cares? Yeah. Or if it's just some strange, crowdy loop, then that's fine as well. Why do you guys work, do you think? What is it?
I mean, we came from a very similar background. We were kind of running into Bobby from 86, you know, and, you know, we were just kind of into the similar music. And, like, we were all really into The Birthday Party, you know, we were all into Honestus and Neubaut, and as much as being into bands like Love or The Birds or whatever. I guess what I mean is I could see them, like, I knew where they were coming from, you know, I knew that they weren't just one thing. They were into, like, a huge range of music.
Yeah.
And especially when they made Screamadelica, I understood where they were coming from. The attitude to music is very unegotistical.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It comes from the perspective of loving music and being huge fans of music. And that was, it was very refreshing to be around that environment, you know, away from myself, you know, which is just in my own world, you know, with the band kind of looking at me going, what are you doing? You know, and then suddenly go into their environment and they're all just bobbing their heads or dancing around and just partying half the time. And but being very, when they work, you know, having a really good work ethic.
I was going to ask you about the first My Bloody Valentine show when you reunited again, but more than the show, what was the rehearsals like? What was it like when you started creating together again? How did it feel? Was there a sense of kind of homecoming? Was there a sense of, like, I don't know, because the expectation was obviously huge, but it doesn't always mean it's going to work, even if people really want it to.
I think because we didn't have a big falling out ever.
Right.
We fell out the way families fall out or, but not even, no, I wouldn't say that. It was kind of like we all started turning 30 and we've been together, me and Colm, since we were teenagers, and there was a sense of, you know, Colm wanted to go off on his own adventure, and, like, even when he, like, left the band, you know, he was still coming around for a good few months and helping with the studio, and you know, I guess we stayed friends and we talked about doing something together again. That's how we broke up.
Right.
And so when we got back together again, it wasn't like we didn't have that energy of, like, you know, don't mention whatever. You
yeah,
know
what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
We didn't have any of that, you know, so we were getting on as people very well.
Right.
You know, and we were relaxed because we never stopped seeing each other or anything.
Right, right.
Yeah, but when we first played, the first song that we played semi-coherently was a song, Coming Alone. And we kind of got through that and we were like, oh, okay, this is good. You know, and then we tried to play another song and it was terrible, you know, really terrible, like really shocking, like, wow, you know. And so there was a sense of, wow, it's just like, it's all there, but you've got to get it back. You've got to kind of rewire everything again.
Yeah.
You know? But it came together kind of reasonably quick, you know, in a few months.
Now you're on Domino. I mean, this is it's been really interesting because they're obviously clearly just a brilliant label, and you've had, you know, I think it's fair to say, a mixed relationship with record labels over the past, and that's not as lots of artists do. And it's kind of really interesting seeing, like, everything's now out on streaming services, and there's this, everyone was really happy when it happened. I think everyone was really happy to see you back on out there. Everyone's really happy to see you on Domino. It felt like a good home and kind of cementing the band to right now.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feel like we made the right decision. I mean, it's funny, you know, because some of the other alternatives that we were considering have all become kind of, they disappeared, you know, that wound up selling to Sony, you know, because I think it was the only way they could survive, really, you know. And Domino are very much like very solid, and they really are, you know, it's a very much a family kind of environment. And it's what we wanted, you know, definitely.
Yeah. And how did you feel about having everything up on streaming sites? Was that something that you took a bit of persuading to do, or was it just about now?
No, not really. I didn't really care too much about it, you know. And then I did notice that I finally wound up getting Spotify and did quite enjoy being able to just check things out.
Yeah.
So it felt kind of hypocritical, you know, to be really against it. I'm looking forward to the future when the sound quality is better, which it is, is happening.
This was going to be a question,
And as everybody else, you know, when it's a bit more balanced financially, but I'm reasonably comfortable with all that
stuff. And the final question, what's the last song we should play? What's the song we should go out on? I know you put some Patti Smith on your list. Maybe that's a good place to finish, but where should we finish? Sure. Where should we finish?
Yeah, I'm finished with Patti.
Tell me about working with her. I mean, cripes.
Well, yeah, that was cool. That was great, you know, really great, lovely experience. When we did the Coral Sea thing, and we just spoke, you know, we just hung out and talked, and I just felt inspired to. I got all my old guitars, all my Jazzmaster Jaguars, and got some of the tunings that I had that I was familiar with.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't like totally unfamiliar, because it was, we were about to play and record a gig, you know, and we hadn't even played a note together, done any music together. But yeah, I mean, she's incredibly inspiring, wouldn't do it justice, but like a sense of bravery, you know, and it was something I hadn't come across before, really. And the thing is, it really worked out.
Yeah.
And you know what we did, but it worked. And if you play the Banga song, that was good. They were playing in a festival, Patti Smith Group, and there was a terrible storm. We couldn't see her beforehand. Kind of got to the gig, well, just before she went on stage. It was on the side of the stage, watching, like, there was, you know, there's always a crowd of people on the side of the stage watching bands. And Patti heard that I was there, and she found me, and she dragged me on stage.
What?
You know, and I was suddenly playing with the band. Yeah, I wound up playing three or four songs with them, and Banga was the one of them. Lenny just shouting out all the chords to me. It was great. Very amazing experience.
Then that's the song that we shall go out on. Thank you.
All good.
Oh, good, man. Thank you so much.
Lyle Degrasse in the heart of the dog. Don't sell all your eggs on the back of a frog. You can lick it twice, but it won't lick you. The salivating salvation's long, so long, so.
That was Banga by Patti Smith, the final choice on my guest here on The First Time this week, Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine. If you head to the BBC Sounds app now, you can listen back to all the other episodes in this series of The First Time, including my chats with Kelly Okereke, Nadine Shah and Kay Tempest. But for now, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.